The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchen.
And me, Lachlan Bloom.
If this is your first time listening, this is a podcast where we speak to other writers of literary fiction about their craft, approach and technique.
And in this episode, we speak to the Israeli writer Edgar Keret. He's mainly known for his short stories, which are exceptionally short, normally sort of around one page. And we had a great chat with him about how he started writing stories initially in sort of solitary confinement in the Israeli army. Well, solitary confinement. He was on guard duty. But it's a fascinating chat about how he approaches writing such short pieces.
I mean, he's a writer rich in metaphor, I think, when he discusses the writing process. He's got some really interesting parallels drawn with sort of surfing and tightrope walking. I've got some good quotes that I pulled out as well, just jotting down while we were interviewing. I'll particularly like, a good story has to be smarter than the person writing it. I thought that's good. I can get on board with that.
I think that might also apply to podcasting as well. A good podcast has to be smarter than the hosts hosting it.
That's down to the excellent guests that we managed to get. Yeah. So thank you to them. And also, writing is dealing with the ecosystem of who you are. Yeah, can absolutely get on board with that.
Yeah. Without any further ado, Edgar Keret. When did you feel that writing was a career or profession? When did you start writing seriously?
I think this moment in my life is yet to come, you know, because I think that in a sense, I always enjoyed telling stories. I mean, even to say, it's not just that I enjoyed telling stories, that I needed stories, or I was dependent in stories to kind of deal with the world. You know, I remember that the first story I've ever made up was when I was about, I think, 6 years old. I went to see a movie in a matinee, you know, like some kind of a Disney movie or whatever. And when I was sitting in my chair, there came this guy who was very tall and who had a cast on his right arm. And he was sitting in front of me, kind of blocking my view. And I didn't know what to do. I was kind of looking for an angle, how I can still see the screen. And then after a couple of minutes, a woman came, and she was also tall, and she had she was holding a popcorn bucket, and she had a full cast too, but on her left arm. And she sat next to that guy, and they were eating popcorn with her good arm, you know. And I don't remember what the movie was, but I remember that I felt this kind of anxiety, this kind of the arbitrariness of life. It didn't make sense. Like, why would somebody with a right broken arm date somebody with a broken left arm? And I remember that by the end of the movie, I came up with this story that they were a brother and a sister, and that they wanted to join the circus. So they made themselves a suit, and they both fit in it together, and they pretended to be a Siamic twins. And the manager of the circus kind of figured out that they were cheating, and he decided as a punishment to break their arms. But because they had this big suit, he forgot that they had their inner arms, so he just broke their outer arms, you know. Now, this was like, it made no sense at all, but my ability to kind of weave some kind of story around something that I didn't understand, it kind of relaxed and made this thing that seemed kind of threatening less threatening, because it, like, a story can contain it, you know. It's like, I don't know, if you have a scorpion and you can put it in a jar, then, you know, then it's a good scorpion, you know, it fits in a jar, you know, it's less scary than this kind of word that you don't get it. And I think that all my young years, I would tell people stories, and it was kind of seen more, I think, as some kind of a tick than a hobby, you know. It's like, I don't think that the word in general, had a lot of patience for my stories, but they knew that whenever something happened and I'm stressed or whatever, I say, hey, imagine a world where people do this and do that. And this woman, she comes, and this guy. And it was something that I never respected in a sense. You know, it was like I understood that I have this problem, but it was like oversweating or sneezing or something. It just takes something that I had to deal with. It was only when I had to go to army service in Israel. You have to go for 3 years when you're 18 for compulsory army service. And it was only during my army service that I basically started writing down stories, because I realized that this kind of thing that was seen as weird but bearable, you know, when you're in high school or in elementary school, it's basically in the army doesn't work. You know, it's like when you with soldiers or with your commander and you say, hey, you know, it's like, you know, imagine that you have this frog and this frog really wants to play the piano, but its weight is not enough, you know, to hit. You're going to get into trouble in seconds. So I was kind of able to hold myself back. And this meant, you know, not only not telling story, but basically not being present. But at the same time, to deal with it, like I still had this kind of need to formulate things around me in stories just to serve as some kind of a metaphor or to break the arbitrariness or my distance from them. And when I wrote them on paper, I realized that it was really kind of, there was something perfect about it, because I could show it to some people that it kind of seemed right, but it wasn't as a, like a reflex, an uncontrollable reflex. And I had this memory, I actually wrote about it, about the first stories that I wrote, because what happened was that in high school, I majored in physics and math, and I was already written. I was supposed to go after my army service to become an engineer. And I remember that the first time I kind of wrote a story on paper, it looked different than when you tell a story in your head. And it kind of almost looked like a story. It almost looked like something that one could read in a book, you know? And in the army, I had to take those 24 to 36 hours shifts where I was completely alone in a closed room. So when I finished writing the stories, it was one page long. I basically had to wait for almost 20 hours before I could meet another person and say to him, hey, you think it's a story? Is it really a story? And that guy was the soldier that was supposed to relieve me from my shift. And when the guy came after 20 hours, I said, look, I wrote something really, really short. I think it's a story. I'm not sure it's a story. Can you have a look? And he said, no, fuck off, you know? So okay. So I took this page and kind of left. And we changed shifts around 6 a.m., which is a very difficult hour to find readers, you know. So I was kind of wandering outside of my the army base, and I went on a bus and took a bus right to the apartment building of my older brother. He was like, I don't know, like 24 at the time or 25, and I buzzed his intercom, and he kind of answered in a very sleepy voice, and I said to him, look, I wrote something I really want you to read, because I want you to see. Can I come up? And he said, no, it's not a good idea. You know, it's not even 7 a.m. and you woke up my girlfriend. And if you come up, it will be really, really messy. But I can come down with my dog and I read the story while walking my dog. And my brother said, sure. And I said, sure. And he came down and he took this page and he started reading it. He kind of read it while walking, and his dog really wanted to kind of relieve his doggy urges. So you can't do that when somebody walks. But my brother was like so much in the story that he kind of didn't notice that the dog was feeling really, really uncomfortable. And I remember this is one of the most stressful moments in my life, because I'm a big animal lover. And I kind of had this instinct to say to my brother, oh, you know, dog, oh, but I see that he's reading and I don't want to kind of stop him from reading. But I see that the dog really, really, and I didn't know what to do. But like, luckily, my stories are really, really super short. So after a few minutes, my brother stopped and the dog did what he planned to do in the first place. And he was looking at me and he said, "You wrote it?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "It's so amazing. Like, I mean, you're my little brother. I love you. You're great. But I would never think that there is such a story kind of hiding in you." And he said, "Can I give you a hug?" And I said, "Sure." And he hugged me and he said, "Do you have another copy of this story?" And I said, yes, of course. And he said, "Ah, great." And he bent down and he picked the dog shit, you know, with the printed page. And as he was doing it, he was talking to me about the story. Like he was saying, "And you know, I really loved that part when this guy can," and he takes the crap wrapped in my story and throws it in a bin, you know, and we just keep on walking. And he's talking, and kind of my look keeps looking at that bin, you know, with flies hovering around my shit-covered story. And I remember this moment as the moment in which I said to myself, "I want to be a writer. That's what I want to do in my life." Because the feelings that I had, it was really like sometimes you have those commercials where they show you that they put a jam on clothes and then they use this special washing powder and it's clean, you know. So I felt that my brother was giving me a demonstration of the power of the stories. Like he said, like, you know, stories are not a piece of paper. Like, I mean, you can throw them in the bin. You can cover them with dog poo. But look, we're walking down the street and I'm still talking about them. Like, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, the story's in my mind. It's there forever. And I think that for me, being in the army, and kind of feeling all the time that everything is a threat. Like, I couldn't help feeling, you know, if I give it to a guy and he reads it and our commander comes into the room and you tear it to pieces or burn down that piece of paper, that guy will already have the story in him. Like, nobody can take it out, you know. No court-martial, no superior officer, you know. The story will be in him forever, you know. And it kind of felt like a superpower or like a magical ability. I think I experienced it as some kind of a fourth dimension, you know, like a place that you can escape to or take a shortcut through, and much less as something that you collect and then publish in books and then do book signings and podcasts about. It was just kind of like a trick, you know. I don't know, it's like when you're a kid and you discover that you can whistle or I don't know, jump on one foot, you know.
So you identified at that point about writing a very short story. That seemed to come there through necessity. But did you feel from that point on that form fitted how your ideas came to you and how you wanted to express yourself? Because that's obviously something you've continued with.
So the thing is that when I discovered writing, I would basically write only short stories. I would say for a period of 3 or 4 years, like, I never even thought about publishing them. The idea was that I would write a story and I would print 4 or 5 copies and I would give them, you know, to my 2 best friends, to my brother, to my mom, you know, and that was the print run. And sometimes if they really liked one story, I would try to write a sequel or something along that vein of the stories that my brother liked or my mom liked. It had these kind of functions that it seemed enough, you know, that I never even kind of considered pushing it. It's funny because I came to publishing my stories in a total random way. It wasn't really like that there was this thing that I say, okay, now I'm going to make it or stuff. It was just I was studying in university and I was in some kind of honors program. So I got a stipendium. Because I would mostly write at night, I would be late for my morning classes, and my marks were good. But the idea was that I disrespect the university because I don't come to all the classes, and maybe that I don't deserve a stipendium. And they did this kind of a academic meeting about my future, and there was a professor who really liked me. And he said, "Look, it's like Better Call Saul, you know. We should build a story. We should have a story when I go there." And he said, "They don't care because your marks are okay, but they feel as if they're not important enough. So we should tell them that you're not doing it because you're doing something as important." And I said to him, "I don't do anything as important. I suffer from insomnia because I did shifts in the army." so I can't fall asleep, so I can't wake up. And he said, but when you're awake, what do you do? And I say, I write. So he said, ah, that's good. You see, you write. And he said, can you give me something that you wrote? And I said to him, why? And he said, because I have a friend who's a professor in the literature department, and I'll give it to him, and he'll give me a letter kind of talking about your writing. And then I come to the committee and I say, you know, yeah, he is an artist. He writes at night. That's why he doesn't come, but he works hard and he keeps his mark. And I said, but what if he's going to say that it's crap? And he said, oh, you don't get it. This is university. You're never going to say it's crap. He's going to say it's subversive. He's going to say it's postmodern. He's going to say something about it. But he's not going to give you a mark, you know. He's just going to say something, you know. I said, okay. And I gave him a few stories. And then the professor, he wrote a letter saying that the stories are subversive and postmodern, as that the other professor kind of anticipated. And he went to the committee and he told them, what do you want, this guy? He writes those subversive postmodern tales. And you don't know. And everyone said, okay, he can keep the stipendium. And I was very happy. And I would say that about the 6 or 8 months later, I got a phone call from the literature professor. And he said, yeah, I wanted to ask, do you have any more texts that you wrote? And I said to him, yeah, but we don't need that anymore. It's okay. They're off my back. Thank you for asking. And he said, no. I just got a position as an editor, and I'm supposed to do this line of avant-garde and kind of relatively new voices. And I remembered that I once saw your text. If you have more and they're as good, I'll publish your book. And basically, this was kind of my publishing story. So there was something I think about my entire relationship with stories, that it was almost like the stories led me somewhere more than I led the stories. And I think that it's only fitting because that's basically the way that I write. You know, when I teach in my university, I often say that I hate it when people tend to see a story as, let's say, as a tool, you know, like a hammer or a knife or something that you can leverage pragmatically. But basically, you're totally in control. You know, you are the master of the story. Because I said that when you write a short story the way that I do, I feel that the story is much more like a horse. Like if you imagine a cowboy's horse. So a horse is not like a hammer in that sense that you don't totally control it. You know, sometimes it doesn't want to ride. Sometimes it goes on his hind legs. Sometimes it sees water and it wants to drink them. But basically, it gives you a much more than a hammer can give you, because it's kind of a partner. And if it doesn't want to go somewhere, maybe there is quicksand or an Indian ambush, or you have some kind of a relationship in it in which you should kind of tell the horse the general direction where you're going, but you should also listen to the horse, you know. And I think that my publishing story is very much like my story writing story, in that sense that I was lucky enough to take some kind of to kind of cling to something that I was never in control of, and that I never intended to have a control of.
Going back to the start, so to speak, when you have the sort of impetus for a new story, was there any difference when you started writing them down as opposed to having them in your head? I mean, you talked when you were 6 and you had that first idea for the story with the people with the broken arms. Presumably at that stage you didn't have a pen and paper in the cinema. It was dark. No. In any case, were you sort of thinking through different possibilities, or did it sort of come fully formed of, oh, Siamese twins, there's a story? Or were you over the course of the film fleshing out, or maybe they had an arm wrestling competition and that's how they broke the opposite arms, or I don't know, do you still kind of look at different possible routes through a story, or does it kind of come in a flash as a, oh, this is the crux of it, and then you might change a few details, but the idea of the story comes in one go?
It depends, you know, the stories change, but I think that, you know, that kind of thinking of another kind of metaphor for that process, I just saw it on Netflix, a series about surfers. What I think is that there is something about this kind of writing that is very much like surfing, in that sense that I think that as a surfer, all the time you're alert and you can take choices, but all those choices have to do with a wave. So the idea is that your decision making is not about, as a surfer, you say, where would I want to go? You say, where is the wave heading and what angle can I be that the wave will still represent me, that I'll still be a part of the wave. I could write a story that I want to write a very optimistic story, but if the story goes south and things go bad, then basically I will not try to impose on the story to keep the original track, because I know that if I do it, I lose the story. I lose the tone of the story. I will say, okay, I'm going to write a optimistic story some other time, because now we're going to massacre this family and feed it to the pigeons, you know? But what can I do? You know, and I feel that there is something, if I try to think about it, I don't know, I think that there is something about this process that kind of helps me feel that I'm not going through the motions, but that I'm actually going through an adventure, because the wave can shift, things can go. So in that sense, the feeling that you are not in control makes the writing much more enjoyable, because basically you write to figure things out. You don't write that you know already something and you want to tell those dumb people who didn't figure it out yet, you know, your smart thing. You know, it's the difference between, I don't know, naturally going on a date with a girl or a guy, and I don't know, things happen and you go to bed. I think it's such a much better scenario than kind of having a page with a few pointers. Don't talk about sport. Go and check in the restroom if you don't smell. I mean, you can get laid this way too, but it's so much less fun. And and there is something that, in a sense, feels less earnest about it. And I think that this kind of consciousness or control is necessary when you write something with a big structure. But when you write the way that I do, and you write for dysfunctions that I guess gets me writing, is that you're really excused from that. And I think that maybe I'm kind of making it up, you know, just to kind of feel better. But I think that it's a bit the difference between writing such a story and writing a story that you plan in your mind. It's like the difference between, let's say, telling you guys a story about a reading that I once had in St. Petersburg, and this guy drank vodka. And I can tell you an amazing story, you know, and you say, wow, my God, this was great. Or if I say, hey, guys, I'm going to a reading in St. Petersburg. I don't know what's going to happen there. I don't know. I think this guy in the back is drunk. You want to come with me? Let's see what's going to happen. It's like I invite the reader to an adventure in which we're basically both in the same position. I'm not a puppeteer kind of manipulating their emotion. I'm just going on a route. And this doesn't mean that I don't have any idea about what I want. I know what I want, and I know that the story has its own gravitational force, and I'm kind of rolling with it. You know, I always tell my students that a good story by definition has to be smarter than the person who's writing it. Because they say, if the story is as smart, you're not writing a story, you're assembling an IKEA furniture. You're basically going through motions. You don't discover something new about yourself. But if you kind of let yourself learn something that you didn't know, then not only you get that, but you get, it's so much easier to write. I'll give you an example. Let's say I write a story, and in my story, I have this general notion that there will be this guy, and he's kind of an asshole, and he's really not nice to his girlfriend, and he fights with her, and on his way back home, somebody mugs him. When he gets mugged, then he learns some humility, and he changes. Okay, this is the story I begin to write. Now, if I get to the mugging scene knowing for sure that this guy is going to survive the mugging, that somebody holds a knife to him, but that he's going to survive it, and then he goes back to his girlfriend, but because he learned something without getting stabbed, then basically I will not be able to write this scene very well, because I would want to get from point A to point B. I would just go through the motions. There would be no sensation. But if I write this scene saying, I really hope that this guy is not going to die, you know, because, oh, shouldn't have said that, you know, or I think the other guy is losing his patience. I hope somebody will arrive soon, you know, because I don't like what the way it's going. Then basically this idea that you're kind of both a initiator and a spectator in your story is really something that that makes it more vivid. And, you know, and that returns me to something from this Netflix Surfer series. It's called a 100 Feet Wave.
Yeah, I think I've seen some of that. He goes off in somewhere off the coast of Portugal.
In Azores. And the favorite geyser is British. He's from Devon. And he's a plumber, and he's a surfer, a plumber with a surfer, or surfer with a plumber. And what I really liked is that they're surfing those huge, huge waves, and they have a lot of accidents. And one of them explains what's the danger in it. And he said, look, when you surf, the only way to survive it is if you're totally in the present. If you say to yourself, this is the wave that I've been waiting for years, or if you say, when I go out, I'm going to say that, or if I fall, I'll try. He said, you're going to drown in a second. You don't have a chance. The only way is that when you're there, you just think about the place that you're in. And I feel that there is something about writing that is very much like that. And the interesting thing about it is that when you're in the present, then there is something not only less rigid, but much more truthful and authentic in you. Because, you know, because when I see an elderly lady in the street trying to cross the street, then I say to myself, I'm a good guy. I've been a good guy all my life. And when they bury me, I would like the rabbi to say that I was a good guy. So I'm going to help this woman cross the street. But when I write a story, I don't have this ego and I don't have this history. So in one story, I might trip this elderly lady, you know, I don't know why, like, you know, just like this dumb asshole, like I would trip her. And then when somebody would come, I say, I don't know, she suddenly fell and then ran, you know, and there is something about it that elderly lady's side of me is never present when I see my life as a whole.
I'm only the lowest doorkeeper. At every hall, there's another doorkeeper. Each one more powerful than the last. Even I cannot bear to look at the third one.
How does it sort of split between the mental storytelling? Like, how much of the adventure or the surfing takes place in your mind before putting pen to paper, or is it inseparable now? Say you see an old lady in the street, and you have a thought of, oh, imagine if I tripped her. I don't know. You may not have a pen and paper to hand. Do you sort of hold on to that thought until later on when you get home and write, or is the creative process only happening when you're in front of your desk with pen, or I don't know if you write on a computer? Is it only happening when your hands are physically writing the words, or are pieces of the stories sort of floating around in your head for a few days or a few hours or a few months?
So let's say when it comes to tripping elderly ladies, I must say it's not as if there is a moment I go, you know, I go on the subway and I say, oh, I'm going to push this woman. I need to write a story to create a situation in which something that exists in me will come out, you know. But what I think is that usually, like, a story for me has this kind of tail, you know, it's like an animal hiding in your home. And sometimes you can see its tail, you know. So I you kind of notice those tails when you walk down the street or when you live your life. And basically you say, like, you know, maybe I'll try and grab that tail. And when that animal will start running around, if I hold tight enough, I'll be able to hold it. But I think that the idea is that when I think about stories, and, you know, and it's funny because there are those stories that I sit down writing without really knowing anything. It just, you know, I can have a sentence in my mind or an image and I just write them and they write themselves. And there are those stories that it's very, very difficult for me to bring myself to sit down and write them. It's kind of like, you know, I have a story, but I have no idea. I'm kind of infamous among writers that I have this tendency, people say that I try to dump stories on them. It's like I sit to them, you know, imagine there are those aliens, and then somebody says, wow, cool, and say, how about you write it? It's a good story. And basically, there is this kind of feeling that you know, it's really like there's something in it. I don't know what to do with it. I've been playing with it in my mind. But, you know, there are, in Nathan Englander's last short story collection, he dedicated kind of two stories for me. It's like one of the stories that he wrote, it's a story about something that happened between me and my dad. It felt like there was some great story in it, you know. I knew that I have no access to it. It just, I can see it, but I can't be it, you know? So I feel that there is something about those second parts that it's a little bit like those stories when you write them, they have some kind of a different aroma, like the aroma of an old wine, you know, or something that kind of feels different. While you have those kind of stories that I wrote in 3 hours without knowing what I'm doing, with it feel kind of more fruity and, you know, and less heavy. And it's funny because, again, you know, if a story is a horse, then you can have so many different relationships with a horse. You know, he could be like one that is, works in your field all day, or it could be a racehorse, or it could be a wild horse that sometimes lets you ride it. And I feel that the story kind of functions in different ways. Stories that come from something that I understand, that leads to something that I don't understand. Story. It's like I always give this example of a breaking point for a story. It's like it's this really thing that happened to me once. I was supposed to go to a job interview, and I had to take a bus. And as I was waiting for the bus, there was another guy in the bus stop waiting with me, and he was kind of better dressed and a bit older than me, and kind of looked like, you know, a cross between me and George Clooney. You know, it was like he was going somewhere, and he was drinking coffee from a disposable cup from the kind of the fanciest cafe in my neighborhood, the most expensive one, and he was holding under his arm a Israeli paper called Haaretz, which is basically like the Guardian or the New York Times, and the. As we were waiting, he kind of moved his arm up because he wanted to take a sip. And when he did that, the newspaper fell, you know, the ones that he was holding under his kind of armpit. He was very cool about it, and he smiled to me, like, and he bent down and he picked the newspaper. And we waited a bit more. And then he came to take another sip, and it fell again. And he got it again. And then when it happened the third time, I burst in tears. Because I'm a very normal person. And I realized that you know, that I can't go to a job interview, you know, with kind of puffy eyes. So I ran back to my home to wash my face. And I said, I'm going to grab a cab and I'll get there in time. And when my wife opened the door, she said, oh, my God, what happened? You know, and I said, I saw the most sad thing in the world. You don't believe it. And she said, oh, my God, sit down. What happened? And then I tell her the story. And she says to me, this isn't sad. This is dumb, you know. Children dying from famine, you know, people getting bombed. That's sad. This guy is just a stupid guy. He could just put a newspaper somewhere and drink it. I said, no, but, you know, and you feel utterly dumb, you know. But there is something that you feel that it's kind of some kind of a unique experience that you can't share, you can't explain to people, you can't show it to people. There is something that you can't name. And when you sit down and you write a story, you take this emotion and you kind of create some kind of a form that makes it public. It's a little bit like you build a bridge that is both between your unconsciousness and your consciousness, but also between your unconsciousness and the world. And I really feel that kind of it's never sitting down to write this perfect story. It's kind of sitting down to write something that has to do with a premise that you think that is interesting, you know? Or it's like I have this newsletter and April is full. I wrote this thing that I called it a fun alternative fact. You know, all those kind of things that are not true, but they're fun. And I started writing this thing that it was a little bit as a story. And the story was kind of started with Elon Musk opening a company in the future that would allow people for time travel, you know, like those kind of flying to space, like SpaceX, it would TimeX, and you could go both to the past and the future. And they want to kind of sell it to rich people, you know. But they have the problem that if they send you to the past or to the future, they can't bring you back. People are kind of reluctant. They say, nah, you know, what, it's like going on a holiday, but never coming back. We don't know. And then they bring this smart guy to the team, and he said, we need to rebrand it. Because the important thing about time travel is that they have this side effect that if you go to the past, you lose some of your weight, and if you go to the future, you gain some weight because of the mass speed thing. So he said, we should just sell it as a diet and say to people, okay, you're going to live in a different time, but you won't be chubby anymore. And this way we can sell it. And then they kind of pick up speed and they sell it to rich people. And the people kind of deciding by how much weight they want to lose, they sell them, they send them to the past. Because if you just want to lose a few pounds, you know, then you just go to the 70s. But if you know really obese, we'll have to send you really like, you know, we don't know how to say it to you, but there will be no electricity there, you know. And what happens is that those fat people from the future being sent to the past, they really form the line of humanity, you know, because like Steve Jobs, you know, he's this fat guy from the 22nd century, you know, who could never keep a diet, you know, he had no weight at all, you know, so he sent him to the past. And the idea is that, so I write this text, and it's basically kind of a premise that rolls in itself. And in the end, there is this character in the story, and he's the inventor of the mechanism. And he's really, really obese. And he goes there in the end, and he said, okay, my job is done. Now you send me to the past. I really want to be skinny. And they said to him, you know the physics, really. Like, man, you're really fat, you know. We'll have to send you way back. And he said, I don't care. You know, you can send me to dinosaur time. I want to be thin enough so I can walk on water. And this is the ending of the story. So I'm saying, so it's not like I was sitting down and say, let's write a story about how Jesus exists. And basically Jesus is so fat, you know, and he, all those people are abusing him. And he say, I can't do it with it. And when he comes back to the past, he carries all these kind of post-traumatic feelings of being an outcast. So he decides to be not. No, it's not like that. You know, it's basically the story rolls itself. So the plot can send you places, or the character that you're creating can send you places. Because I write sometimes stories about all kinds of like smart-ass guys, basically because I guess I'm also kind of a smart-ass guy. And many times they get into spots that I have no idea what to say or how to get out of it. But because I know the characters so well, so it's almost like I say, if I was this guy, that's what I would say, you know? So it's not in a conscious way, but in an unconscious way, I say, I don't know what to do, but Charlie does. So I tell you what, you know, and then it kind of helps you kind of access some places, I don't know, in your mind that you can't reach them through a road. You can just kind of teleport there.
To get to the sort of start of a story, do you take notes at all? That story you just described with the time travel. I mean, I can see the sort of the evolution of the story to the point where the inventor is Jesus, but the crux, the idea of sending people back, that must have occurred at some point. Would you sort of take a note to time travel, people get thinner, or, you know, just a few words to remind yourself, and then the next day when you're sat at your desk, you'd start exploring where this story could go? Or would you not take any notes and just rely on the fact that if it's a good idea, it'll come back to you when you need it?
Well, I think it's very rare that I kind of take those notes. I can tell you that right now, let's say I have something like about 8 stories that I'm kind of wrestling with. And with each of them, it's a different kind of wrestling, you know, because let's say one of the stories has a premise and a sensation, but it has no plot at all. And the other stories, they're basically, I write them, I begin writing them, but I feel that the tone is off. And there are some stories that I know the plot, but I have no idea how to write it. So I have about 8 of these, but I can say to you that I think that in an average day, I have ideas for more than one story every day. And I write a story, I would say, about every 2 months, you know. So basically, it's in the end, I write a story out of, I don't know, 600 ideas for stories or openings for stories. And I think that that there is some kind of an evolutionary model there, because to become one of the 8, you know, I have to feel a lot for you. I have to wrestle with you. Maybe in the end, when I sit down to write, some other story from the past will kind of just kind of run out of its cage and kind of take control. But I kind of have this feeling that in this kind of sea of stories, that those stories that are really important for me, they're going to come back or hang out there.
You don't have a list, like if you are having an idea for a story every day, you're not jotting that down in some form or thinking, I'll come back to that. It's just the idea comes, and then if in 2 months' time it reoccurs to you and you like it, you'll go with it.
Yeah, and again, you know, it's not like kind of I'm a socialist and a communist, and that's why I live in a small apartment. I'm not good in business, you know, and that's why I live in a small apartment, you know. I think that the way that I act is, I have a lot of bitterness towards myself about that, you know, because I think that, you know, whenever I feel maybe, I don't know, disconnected or greedy or unhappy, I can sit down and say, oh my God, there are so many stories that you could have written and that you don't write, and so many good ideas that you've forgotten. More than that, you know, there are stories that I wrote and that I forgot that I wrote them. It's funny because I have a personal assistant that when I have birthdays, she has a copy of my hard disk, and she just roams through my hard disk, and every birthday she gives me a text I wrote that I forgot that I wrote it, you know, because I can't even keep one folder for the stories that I like, or come up with what you write in the end of the file of the name of the final thing, because sometimes I write final, sometimes I write final. Sometimes I write, that's it, you know, and then I can't find anything anywhere. And I think that most of the time I say to myself, you know, that's a good deal. Basically, I enjoy writing stories and I'm kind of doing well. And, you know, and these two guys from Britain, they want to talk to me about stories. So I must be doing something right. I'm a professor in the university. And basically, it's good enough, you know. Okay, so sometimes I lose change, coins fall. Your life is good. You don't need to change them. But there are those moments, you know, especially when I don't write well or when I'm not able to kind of express myself in writing, that I say, you know, if somebody else had your abilities, he would do so much more out of it. And, you know, like I feel like kind of a first grade teacher is talking to my mom, you know, or something.
And do you have a sort of a sense of how far through, how far you want to progress with a story before you're happy that it's going to sort of survive and you're going to work on it? I mean, do you have a kind of, I don't want to say a huge collection of dead ends, but are there stories that you just know you just can't get the shape of, you feel there's something there and they're just, they're waiting to be worked on? But I mean, you've got to a more formal point. You have actually been writing them, working on them, not just thinking about them.
So I think, again, you know, I'm just, the honest disclosure, whenever I use a metaphor, it means that I don't really have an answer. So instead I use a metaphor. But I think that let's say if you imagine like a tightrope walker in a circus, then the idea is that when you're on a tightrope, you want to get to the other end. You know, you don't want to fall. When you surf, you don't want to fall off your board if the wave is too big. You want to get there. But the idea is that kind of trying to get there is basically what you enjoy. So if you walk a very long rope, you say, haha, this is the Guinness record, you know, me walking on it. And in hindsight, maybe you'll appreciate or you like it. But basically, when I write a story, in an unconscious way, I always try to write those stories as short as I can. Basically, I kind of like I want to get somewhere. And this idea is that I'm writing a story because I want to get somewhere. And this thing is metaphorical, you know, it's not a bottom line. But I want to get to this part in the world where this emotion and thing I don't understand is articulated. You know, I get on a plane, I want to get there. You know, there is something very impatient about it. But at the same time, I can tell you that there are many stories that I actually sat down having a strong feeling saying, okay, like I say to my wife, yeah, no, okay, it's morning, I'll meet you for lunch. And then basically 6 or 7 hours later, I'm still hammering at it and I'm not even in the half point of the story. Because again, it's like trying to get somewhere, you know, it's like you think that you can, but if the road is blocked or if something happens, then it takes its own control of the situation.
During that process, are you working on the sentences, editing the sentences to just try and get the right feel? Or do you try to get from sort of A to B and then go back and redraft a lot?
I think that my editing process is really strange because I have kind of an extra editing stage that novelists are excused of. And that when I write a story, I'm not happy with it, then many times, and you know, it's extreme, but many times what I basically do is I take drafts that I've written, I read it, I throw it away, and I sit down and I write the entire story from scratch. And the idea is that when you read a story fast, basically there are a few things in it that stay with you, like, you know, a metaphor, a sentence, a situation, a picture, but a lot of it gets washed away. And many times when I do this kind of process, I write a second version that is less good than the first one, you know. And then what I do is that I compare the two and I return to the first one, and then I try to add things from the second one. But this idea of kind of writing it from scratch, it kind of gives you this freedom to change things that you can't change when you edit a text. You know, it's really like, let's say things about the story's tempo or meter. There are things, you know, sometimes because if a story is just kind of a sensation that you cannot explain or you cannot break to molecules, then sometimes you need to go all the way back. But I have these things that sometimes, let's say I write a story and it's a first person narrative story and I'm not happy with it. And I say, I'll try to write it third person narrative and then see if it works better. And then I write it third person narrative and it doesn't work. But I discover something about the plot. Because only when I wrote it in third person, I became aware, it's as if like your camera frame changed. Because when I wrote it in third person, I wasn't in this guy's kind of mind and psyche. Then I was cool enough to realize that he actually had more options than I saw when I wrote it in first person. So it's I know that it feels kind of like a kiddie show, but it's a little bit like, I don't know, kind of getting into a cupboard or using your time machine, going somewhere, trying something, leaving. And these are the more kind of extreme things. And sometimes you write a story and you say something in the ending doesn't work, or the middle is too long, or, you know, I wrote that because I needed it because I didn't know at the time. I just added this character. He never returns. Who needs him? You know, so it could go many ways. But I think that it's funny because if there's something that this kind of feeling of lack of total control, when I write, I feel the same thing about editing. Like, I feel that there is nothing totally scientific in it, you know, that there is nothing that I can totally rely on. I can have some kind of techniques, you know, that are usually weird. You know, it's like every story that I write, when I read it, I always try to read it without the first sentence. And if it works, I try to read it without the second sentence. And if it works, I try, until it stops working. And you know, and sometimes I could write a five-page story, and going through this process, it becomes a two-page story. It just kind of starts much, much way after I wrote the story. You know, so I can do all kinds of processes, but even when I do those processes, it feels more like kind of a casting a spell than writing a computer program. It's kind of, you say, maybe it will work. I don't know why. You know, it's not, I never feel this kind of idea. You know, it's like, I'm kind of professor in university and people like to use terms like masterclass. And, you know, and sometimes if I go to give a reading in the US, they'll say one of the masters of the short stories or something like that. And it always kind of feels a bit wrong, you know, almost kind of like you're an imposter or something. I really feel that that there is something about writing, that this is the thing that I don't know and understand in life. There are so many other things that people could say that I'm the master of, you know. I'm the master of hummus, for example. I know anything you need to know about hummus, I can do, you can blind me and I can still tell you any hummus from which restaurant in Israel it is. But when it comes to writing, it's like this idea, what, like I'm supposed to teach you something? Yeah, yeah. You know, when you see people in bus stop, cry a lot, okay? Cry a lot and then fight with your wife. It's good for story. Like, I mean, what is this thing, you know? And it's funny because when you're a writer, you always find yourself in the end teaching. And for me, it was really kind of meeting with students. It was all about, in the beginning, saying to them, you know, this is not a school. You know, this is a support group. You know, we're all alcoholics. We're doing weird stuff. We sit down. We make up stories that never existed. Most people don't do that. But we can get up and tell a story, and then everybody will come and hug that woman or man and say, it's all right, Irene. We also do that. It's okay. We also make up stories. You know, we love you. And the idea I could say is that, I don't know, for me, teaching maybe is a little bit like kind of a stuttering psychotherapy, maybe. It's really like when you work with students, it's more about kind of trying to figure out with them, what are they interested in? Why do they do things? You know, or kind of look with that on some details in life with them, kind of in a higher resolution. But in the bottom line, it's really like it's like if you reading the internet, you know, want to make women fall in love with you, send us £5 and never get anything in return. You know, so it's really, so when people say, you know, that they can teach other people how to write, they feel like quacks. You know, I actually feel that any person in the world can write. But it's their problem, you know, to get there. And, you know, I'll be happy to give some tips. But to think that, you know, it's that they find a Mr. Miyagi in the woods that tells them what to do and then they come out a writer, it's really kind of misunderstanding the concept of writing. You know, it's really, I say to my students that each of them is like a planet. And I said to them, I can visit your planet, but I can't give you a tour guide to the planet because you've been living on it all your life. I can go on your tour guide and ask you, and what's this thing? And you can say, I never noticed this strange and scary animal in the woods. Thank you for telling me that. But in the bottom line, writing is about kind of dealing with the ecosystem of who you are. You know, you can't bring an outside expert to teach you that.
So following on from that, I guess this might be extending the surfing metaphor too far, but I mean, in that Netflix dude, he traveled specifically to the location in Portugal to find this wave. Do you have any either physical places or mental places that you kind of go to? I mean, as a surfer, a surfer might be sitting in his car on the land and he has to then make a conscious choice to go somewhere to hunt for waves. And then once he's in the water, he has to also be aware and looking around for the wave to catch. I don't know if this metaphor extends that far in your perspective, but do you have places or routines or habits that you go to? I mean, obviously that's different for every writer, what works for them, but like, do you have a certain place where you like to write, a certain way of writing? I mean, on a practical level, do you write with a pen or a computer or read aloud?
So I write on a computer because my handwriting is not very clear. And the thing is that the more excited I become, the less clear it becomes. So, at some stages, like, I would write to myself stories on paper and it was unable to read what I wrote, like certain sentences. It was super frustrating because it's also like, it's like a curse because the sentences I can't read are the ones that I was most excited when I wrote them. And usually you're excited because you nailed something, you know? So it was really like, I realized that I should move to a computer. And I think that that for me, when I write, of course, like, you know, they have those kind of writer houses. You know, I wrote one of my books in a place near Monaghan in Ireland, the Tyrone Guthrie Institute. And it's really great, you know, when you go to those places that they're very quiet and they may prepare food and all the other people, they're also writers and they don't think you're weird and stuff. But for me, it's kind of nice. And if I go to a place like that, I would write more. But technically, I think I can write anywhere. The thing about it is that I need to kind of isolate or kind of deny the reality around me, which means that I can't write in a space where, let's say, I hear other people speaking, because it makes me aware that I'm not in the story and that I'm in another place. And also, I can't write, let's say, in cafes and stuff because apparently I say things out loud when I write, or, you know, I do all kinds of stuff. Like, you know, I pick my nose all the time or scratch myself. And usually, like, I live in Israel, which is a very warm country. So I usually write in my underwear and, you know, or naked, you know. And so there is something very not social. It's as if when I write a story, I'm not in the place that I physically am, I'm in another place. So I remember that I was once in this beautiful writer's colony called the McDowell. It's in New Hampshire. And the idea is that they have those huts for writers, and those huts are in the forest, and you have beautiful view. And because there are huts, and you have like view from three directions, and you just see forest, you don't see any buildings. And I would spend hours looking out of the window. And one day, another writer from the colony came to visit me. And he asked me, he said, you know, when I look at the place that you're staying, I see that your laptop is pointing the restrooms. Basically, when you sit, you see the restrooms, and you're in one of the most beautiful places in the world. Why would you want to write facing the restrooms? And I said to him that when I had to find my writing place, then I thought, you know, that when I don't write, all the time I look outside of the window. So when I write, I really don't care because I'm not in a forest, you know. I'm robbing, you know, a bank, you know, in Atlanta. So who cares if they are deer? Like, I'm writing a story, you know. I'm in my mind. So it kind of became natural. And I think historically, it's always the same. You know, the place that I write, it's basically the worst spot in my apartment. It used to be a toilet. And it seems okay because I'm writing. So what, like, I'm not having fun here. You know, I'm doing stuff. It's just kind of like a portal that I'm going through. And it would look unfair to waste this space, you know, for all the times that I'm actually in the moment and can smell, watch, enjoy things.
Well, thank you to Edgar for joining us, and thank you to you for listening. We will include information about Edgar and his writing in the notes below this episode with links, etc.
And Edgar does have a newsletter you can follow where you can read some of his writing. Well worth following.
Yeah, it's well worth signing up for.
And you can follow and find us online with unsignedmethods.co.uk. We're on Twitter at unsignedmethods. And you can find me in my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
I'm on Twitter at Jamie Batchin, spelt in my idiosyncratic way. Instagram is at Jamie_Batchin. And I have just worked on a new website. I've shifted host. It's pretty much the same text as it always was, but now that it's a little bit easier for me to edit, I'm hoping to put a little bit more stuff on there. Thanks again for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.